Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The Willamette River is the most industrialized and polluted river in Oregon. Weaving through the state's largest city, it has been reshaped and abused for 150 years. 22 years ago, the last 10 miles of the Willamette, home to the Portland Harbor and critical energy infrastructure tank farms, was designated a Superfund site, which is finally about to be cleaned up. But once the Willamette was a thriving braided river ecosystem supporting indigenous communities and abundant wildlife, you can still see glimmers of that past along slim sections of the river in Portland, which can help us imagine what the rest of the river might look like again if it is properly cleaned up and protected. Today we talk with Travis Williams, Executive Director of Willamette Riverkeeper, about how to address the harms perpetrated on our beloved river and envision a healthy, happy Willamette for generations to come. Travis, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hey, thank you, Barbara.
And we're talking to you from Minnesota, is that correct?
That is correct.
So you're gone from the land of rivers to the land of many lakes.
That's right. Yeah, my family was able to take a little break here, and we're headed back to Oregon.
Well, a few weeks ago, you took me to a spot on the Willamette that I don't think very many people spend time at. It's a very formerly polluted and probably still polluted stretch of the river behind the property that belonged to McCormick and Baxter. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what that stretch of river is like and what it's reflective about what we have done to the Willamette River. I mean, we, kind of figuratively speaking, over the last 150 years.
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting place on a number of levels. I've been working on that stretch of river for the last 22 years with Willamette Riverkeeper, and it's been a real education for me and a lot of other folks in our community who care about that stretch of river. But you think of a river 200 years ago that had a much more connectivity with its floodplain, lots and lots of wildlife down in that corridor, and, you know, lush riparian areas and lots of interconnections with the floodplain, as I mentioned. And today that has been really relegated to something of the past. We have an area that has been dredged and built up, and a lot of that dredged material was put along the riverside, which are now the areas that we see industry and have seen industry for many decades. The river, the very shape of it is kind of a large, shallow U if you looked at the bank dropping off on one side and then crossing the river and then going back up on the other side. Instead of kind of having a lot of shallow water habitat, you have something that gets pretty deep pretty quick. So the very, you know, the physical nature of that stretch of river is completely different. And then overlaying that, you have a lot of the area that was filled in and built on. Those were the very soils that were contaminated by industrial activity over the decades. And then, of course, because that material can be very permeable, meaning that water and other substances can make their way through the sand and rock that was placed in there, which a lot of it, again, came from the river originally, that material made its way to the river itself, which, as you mentioned, resulted in our Superfund site listing. So, you know, if you're sitting down there as you and I did, though, there are some signs of hope, but that's kind of the gist of how that whole stretch of river is today.
Well, I heard Bob Salinger a few months ago refer to the Willamette. He said it was once a braided river. What did he mean by that?
Yeah, typically a braided river really means something that can move around in its floodplain. So it'd be a little more common to refer to a braided river, maybe higher up in the Willamette system. But I think Bob's sentiment remains important because even that lower floodplain stretch of river that has a tidal influence, so when you go from Willamette Falls down to the confluence with the Columbia, that's 26.5 miles of water that rises and falls with the tide. And I think a lot of people in Portland don't always know that. And they say, wow, the river really receded quickly. Well, yeah, that's the tide going out. But a braided river, back to your question, is a river that has islands and side channels and has the ability to move around seasonally at times, but also over time, the river can literally change its full channel, or the primary channel becomes different. So, again, that's a river that can move around, that idea of braided. If you think of those channels just moving from upstream to down, around islands, big islands, small islands, series of floodplain connections. It's that natural movement which rivers have always done and always tried to do. And ultimately, I think we're going to see that, you know, as much as we try to beat them back in some cases, historically, that they end up winning in the end, if you will.
When I came to Portland, which was like 51 years ago, and there were two signs that I'd see along the roadways that really puzzled me. And one was a sign for Swan Island, and another one was a sign for Giles Lake. And I couldn't figure out where the island was in Swan Island, and I couldn't figure out where the lake was for Giles Lake. So I want to talk about what those places were and what we did to them so that there is no longer an island. Swan Island's turned into a peninsula, I guess, sort of, and Giles Lake has virtually disappeared.
Exactly, yeah. So you're exactly right. Swan Island is today a peninsula that was connected on the upstream end, affording access across land to what used to be the island. And today it's a highly industrialized area. There's a lot of manufacturing that still goes on down there. But back in the day, that was a sizable island in the middle of the Willamette. And really speaking to that idea of a big river like that being braided. Similarly, with Giles Lake, you had a big lake on the west side, just north of northwest Portland, that was completely natural, connected to the Willamette at many times, depending on flows. And over time, that was drained and filled in. So you've got, in essence, a lot of industrial activity that takes place today, and to some degree where we drive on the highway there between Scappoose and Portland. All of that area was lowland and just teeming with the lake and other wetlands. And you try to imagine back in the day when that was just full of waterfowl and all manner of mammals that call this area home, and fish, and just an amazing natural area that, of course, is today vastly different.
Now, I wonder if we could look at Vancouver Lake as perhaps sort of an example of what Giles Lake was like in relationship to the Willamette.
Yeah, I think you could draw some comparisons for sure, potentially size wise, and just sort of how that lake functions to some degree. But yeah, it's definitely a very different place today, that's for sure.
Well, one of the things that gives me a tiny bit of solace living in Portland, because of where I live in Portland, I am close to the single stretch of the Willamette River in Portland, which is still natural, or semi-natural.
Right.
We have a beach, and you talked about the tidal influence, and that was something I wasn't aware of until I had lived along, well, I don't live along the river, but I live like a 15-minute walk to this stretch of beach, and I would notice sometimes that the river had been quite high and onto the beach before I got down there, and sometimes it was very, very low. And I remember being down there one time with some old timers, and this woman made a remark about low tide, and then I suddenly got it because I knew about the Columbia being tidal influence all the way up to Beacon Rock. So it was like, oh, of course, this is tidal influence. But I think that part of the reason why a lot of Portlanders don't have an understanding of the fact that the Willamette River is tidally influenced throughout Portland is that we don't spend a lot of time on the river, unless you happen to be fortunate to live along one of the few stretches of river that still you have access to. Let's talk a little bit about why that is such a big problem.
Yeah, well, it is kind of interesting. If you think of Portland, I think over the last 20 years has really characterized itself as a quote-unquote river city with river access. And, you know, at the end of the day, when you look at that stretch of river, let's say between, oh, I guess, Kelly Point Park at the confluence of the Columbia, where there's a nice public park owned by the city of Portland, and then Selwood, the opportunities to actually get on the water are relatively few and far between. So you've got, you know, the seawall, quote unquote, the river wall in downtown Portland. We have the Esplanade, which kind of gets you up above the water, but there's really not a lot of great connection to it. We have a couple places where there's a, you know, floating dock that provides some access. And then you have a couple of nascent access points that have been around for a long time that others now are seeking to use for swimming, and that's good. But after that, you know, if you really look at ways to get to the river, they're pretty you have some really big gaps. You know, there's Willamette Park up off of McAdam on the west side of the river. You have Selwood Riverfront Park that you were talking about. But again, those access points that are safe and easy to get to the water itself are not all that numerous. And I think there's things that we could do over time, certainly in the city of Portland, with, I think, a little bit greater effort to try to create those connections where they don't exist today. You know, we know of there's a whole group of rowing clubs and paddling groups, too, that have tried to seek to have a permanent boathouse along the Willamette, and that's been a really hard thing to accomplish. So that's my really long way of saying I think it's a little bit counterintuitive that, you know, again, we have this long stretch of river that goes right through the heart of the city, but in terms of getting to the water to go swim, to throw a boat on it, or to just sit at the water's edge, there's not a lot of access in compared to how many miles of river we have in town.
You forgot to mention Poets Park, by the way.
Which
is an interesting place, actually, because I used to live in Lair Hill, and this is back in the 80s, and people in the neighborhood were talking about trying to develop that little, it was a little sandy beach that was like under the Markham Bridge, basically, and they were saying, this is great river access. And then many, many years later, I started hearing about Poets Park and realized that's the park people were talking about. I haven't actually been down there, but I'm wondering, is Poets Park actually a pretty decent access? I mean, it's tiny compared to where I live, but it's still right sandy beach.
All these, the funny thing about it is we're kind of slapping names on spots that people have used for years, which you kind of made clear there. I think the one difference, though, if you think about Portland is, you know, that particular access is under a freeway. Across the river, you're still under a freeway. The Esplanade goes along a freeway. And, of course, if you really go back in time in Portland, and freeways have become a very big issue in relation to, you know, justice in our communities, where things were placed and who was displaced. But I think if you look back many, many decades, I think of my parents' time and my grandparents talking about this, there wasn't a lot of agreement that that was a great idea to slap a freeway right on the side of a river. And as we saw in Seattle, you know, they've started to undo some of that infrastructure to the benefit of community access. And if you think about how awesome and peaceful our downtown could be if that freeway wasn't there. I'm not suggesting that this is anything that's going to happen tomorrow, but you know, it is kind of interesting when you look at the development of cities where we choose to put things, frankly, to the detriment of community health and community access. It does make a lot of sense in the case of Portland.
Well, you have to give Portland some credit back in the 70s, because when I came here in 71, there was basically a freeway on the west side of highway where Waterfront Park is now. But that did seem to me to actually indicate that even back in the 70s, there were some people who were a little bit more forward-thinking about reclaiming the river for people and away from freeways.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm not. My critique is not to suggest that we haven't done some good things and some very progressive things and kind of really thinking broadly about the future of a city like Portland. But if you think about where River Place is today, that used to be an industrial site. Some of those old photographs are just amazing. And then you see the freeway right there, which is basically where Waterfront Park is and NATO Parkway. But again, that being said, I think we have a ways to go.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUNA and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Travis Williams, Executive Director of Willamette Riverkeeper, about how to address the harms perpetrated on our beloved river and envision a healthy, happy Willamette for generations to come. Back in the 70s, KBOO was not where we are now on the east side of the river, but we were actually just half a block up from the river on the west side on Yamhill Street. And it was this historic building, and there were all these photographs of old Portland. And some of the interesting ones were pictures of the waterfront in downtown Portland in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And industry was built right up to the river in downtown Portland, too.
Yeah.
And I wonder what kind of role model that set for future development that's brought us to the present moment.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, if you look at, I think one kind of cool thing that has been done is some of the interpretive kiosks or signage that's down along the East Bank Esplanade where you can see some of those old photographs of the piers going right into the water from the local streets that intersected with the river. And, you know, it does explain a lot, I think, about how we have ended up where we are in relation to developing right along the river and where you place freeways and other large infrastructure. So it's at the same time, you know, those times too are, it's pretty amazing to imagine when you look at the river now, what that must have looked like and felt like and frankly smelled like with the type of activity that was going on in that area. And where I think you're going with this too is the consequent impact on the river. There's a very large house on the river on the west side, just upstream of Waverly Country Club, which is upstream of the Silver Bridge, if folks could kind of imagine that stretch. And the base of that large structure is actually part of the old foundation for the water intake for the city of Portland that used to draw from the Willamette. And when you think of, you know, even in the very early times, that water was clean enough to, you know, consume and use for a whole variety of purposes, including drinking water. But of course, there came a time when having something like that just a few miles up from downtown Portland was no longer suitable because of water quality concerns and everything from harmful pathogens to other types of pollution. And of course, Portland, in our case, we have Bull Run, which was transitioned to. But I think when you saw the advent of, you know, building along the river and utilizing it and for shipping and factories and all types of other behavior, it is interesting to think of that transition. As a city grows, you are basically outgrowing your clean water supply in that process during the 1800s and into the early 1900s.
Well, it's also interesting to think about how we have disconnected ourselves from so many of our functions, whether it's where we put our garbage or where we get our water from, that we, yeah, here we have this incredible resource, this river that runs right through the city, which if in a perfect world we could drink from. So we have to go and take the water from 20 miles southeast of Portland to have, and we have a great water source, but part of me thinks, isn't it weird that we have to go that far to get water? Now, there's nothing like New York City, who also, New York City actually, well, they have an actual river in New York, it's called the Bronx River, and most of the rest of what surrounds Manhattan is estuary. So yeah, I don't think you're going to drink from the Hudson River down there, but certainly there are closer water sources for New York than where they drink from the Delaware River up in upstate New York. So I think that you look at the problems in Portland in relationship to our the way that we treat our rivers, it's not just all over the United States. It's probably all over the industrialized world, and certainly a habit that settlers from Europe brought with them from Europe. So I wonder if we're at a point now where we're really starting to rethink our relationship to these incredible water bodies that flow through our cities or that we're built upon, and how we can start to reclaim this really industrialized, contaminated past.
Yeah, and before I get to that, I would just touch on something that I think is important. And, you know, my organization, you know, works on water quality and habitat restoration throughout the whole of the Willamette. And we get involved in a lot of different things, from litigation under the Clean Water Act to habitat restoration in the floodplain. We're actually doing some land acquisition now and a whole host of other activities and helping to get people on the water. So I wanted to say that before I forgot. But you're hitting on something that I think is really interesting that none of us think enough about, and that is the way in which we use water. We're so accustomed to, you know, being able to flush your toilet and have that waste go elsewhere for someone else to manage. And yes, we all, if you're a ratepayer, you're paying for that on a monthly basis typically. But if you look at the use of water and how overtly we use water, even in a region that, you know, decades ago we wouldn't have thought about, northwestern Oregon having potential water issues in terms of availability, but, you know, that's something we're starting to see, and especially in the face of climate change. You know, during the peak time of summer, where the water is least available, and we have reservoirs on the Willamette. But we've seen in recent years that, you know, there's some inkling that that vast amount of water is not going to be the same over the next, you know, few decades, even in very wet regions. And at least there's the potential for that. But then, you know, and I would bring this down to, people can imagine, you know, you go camping, maybe it's at a campground that doesn't have a water source, we all think much more carefully about the water you use. So, you know, when you're washing dishes, when you're drinking water, when you're using it for cooking, suddenly you're in kind of a different dynamic. And I would encourage people in some ways, if they could do that, even in their own home use, to start to think about water in a different way. Because certainly, you know, we've got regions of the U.S. that have water problems right now. And they've got to take action to, you know, really deal with it. And I think, so again, that's a bit of a slightly off topic here from the Willamette, but at the same time, very much connected.
My water bill has gotten very high in the last few years, and I've started thinking about our profligate use of water. So maybe part of it is we need to pay more for our water. We might treat it a little bit better and a little bit more judiciously.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I know there's been a lot of complaints in the city of Portland in terms of how high our rates are compared to other areas. And just as a reminder, one of the main reasons for that is that we did build the big pipe, which was built to intercept those sewage overflows that we had had because we, you know, we as a city grew to a point that we were too many people for our existing infrastructure. And so that, you know, when it would rain, it would sweep the sewage basically straight into the Willamette if there was enough of the stormwater combining with our sewer water. So that's a whole other topic we could talk about for an entire hour. But again, the reason for that is that we have one of the earlier rebuilds of our system, if you can characterize it that way, versus other cities that are just getting to those projects now, and they will see their rates increase as well. But I think it does, again, get down to that value. Like, what are you using water for? How, you know, do you walk away from the faucet for a minute, leave it on, and, you know, that type of thing we just should not be doing. It's a lot of those little actions, you know, that can certainly add up.
You're mentioning the rest of the Willamette River besides what flows through Portland, and I wanted to talk a little bit about what the rest of the river is like and the lessons we can learn from spending some time, even just as far upstream as West Lynn, that we can learn about how we need to rethink our relationship to the Willamette as it flows through Portland and what the river could be like in Portland as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, the river as it goes, if you go upstream of, let's say, Selwood Bridge, you know, the geology starts to become a little bit different. You have a lot more basalt on the shoreline. And as you keep going up toward Lake Oswego, the river gets very deep. You're kind of in a basalt trench. There are areas where it's naturally 80 to 100 feet deep in places. You certainly have a lot of housing and typically large homes that are right on the riverside with lawns. And some people do a great job in terms of, you know, utilizing natural native plants to, you know, retain soil and to not have a big green lawn that they're fertilizing and watering. And others haven't quite caught on. but as you keep going, you're still in that basalt trench all the way to Oregon City, where, again, before you get to Willamette Falls, the river gets very deep in places, and oftentimes you can find sturgeon in those kind of deep holes. There's another one right around Elk Rock, which is a City of Portland-owned property that happens to be in the city of Milwaukee. A little confusing there, but they made a transition years ago for that. But that's another wonderful access point. Incidentally, you can look up on the cliff face across from Elk Rock, and oftentimes there is a peregrine falcon nest right on that cliff face, a very natural place for such a nest to be. And, of course, you mentioned Bob Salinger earlier. He and Audubon Society of Portland have done great work to kind of bring those birds back, and everything from the Interstate Bridge, where they have a nest, to St. John's Bridge. So folks should also know that there is a peregrine falcon nest typically on the St. John's Bridge and on the Interstate Bridge across the Columbia. And my friend, and you mentioned him earlier, a colleague, Bob Salinger of the Audubon Society of Portland, and that operation have done a lot to bring those birds back over the years, and really cool to have right in the city. And, of course, we have those as you go upstream as well into the Willamette Valley. But, you know, so back to your question, though, the suburbs typically just have a lot of suburban housing along that stretch of the river. There are some nice nodes of natural habitat, like Mary S. Young Park, which is a state property managed by the city of West Lynn. You've got Melton Bar Park, which is a popular access point, and Dahl Beach, kind of right at the confluence of the Clackamas. There's a nice little island there as well called Goat Island, which is at the confluence of the Clackamas. So there's definitely some nice attributes. And to your question about in Portland and Portland Harbor, I think over time we can find more properties that can be utilized for park spaces and river access points and open space. And you brought up, Barbara, the property where you and I met a couple of months ago, the former McCormick and Baxter wood treatment site, which was an early Superfund site on that stretch of river. It was an independent site that was listed before that 11-mile stretch of river, which is also a Superfund site. But they had highly contaminated soils that were basically full of creosote. So that's the type of material that treats railroad ties and pilings that you actually find in the river. And that site was completely cleaned up, at least as of the technology of 1997, 98, and into the early 2000s. It's capped, so it's safe for human use. You can actually go to that area. The beach is covered with an interlocking blanket of concrete blocks, which is very strange if you happen to paddle up to it or boat up to the site. But it's a 44-acre site in the heart of Portland Harbor that has a really nice feel to it if you go there, and it's kind of surprising, but it would make a great open space for the community. And it's just upstream from another site that is owned by the Metro Regional Government called Willamette Cove. And you could have two sites there that would create probably close to 70 acres of river access, habitat for wildlife, relative peace and quiet, which is actually pretty surprising in the heart of that industrial area. But unfortunately, McCormick and Baxter has just been languishing for years. The company, when they finally got to the last phase of cleaning it up, the federal government actually provided several $1 million to do the final touches. The company had no more money. But it's interesting, today that company still controls the fate of that property. They have to agree, along with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, to move it on to another type of use. And they have been approached by multiple folks with ideas about having some form of open space there, and it just has not happened yet. That's unfortunate. But that's my long way of answering your question. I think opportunities like that and others that you see up and down through that industrialized stretch will see more of them come along, and we should try to take advantage of it and put some dollars out there to acquire these properties or figure out ways to lease them long term to the public benefit.
Well, another community we haven't talked about yet is Linton, which is probably one of the most abused communities in Portland, and it's right on the river, and there's no river access. Let's talk a little bit about the issues at Linton and how they got that way.
Yeah, I have been talking with folks in Linton for the last couple of years, and there's a really thriving group there that's trying to create some river access. And I think over time, properties were bought up, and the idea of having a riverside trail there became more and more difficult to accomplish. The riverbank there is relatively steep, and even we had a big project go in there. It's called a mitigation project for Portland Harbor, and that's where a company would come in and acquire property like that, which they did right in Linton. I think it's about 23 acres. I might be off by an acre or two there. But they did a restoration project, and unfortunately, when they did that, they didn't allow any sort of public access. So you've got this big kind of amorphous upland property with some shallow water habitat that's low down to the river, but there's no opportunity to have a trail or a trail that goes down to the river. And we've talked with NOAA Fisheries over the past couple of years about that missed opportunity, and really it should have been incorporated into that project. So a group of folks have been working with another local landowner who, in their view, has been difficult to work with over the past few years, but recently they've had some good talks about creating a trail that would go down to the water from Linton. So again, if you think about the oddity, if you will, of having one of the first towns, riverside towns, on the Willamette, for white settlers, that is, to be a place where today you have really no public land or public access to the river there, it's an awful strange conundrum. But again, I'm hopeful that in talks with this landowner that they'll be able to figure something out along with the city of Portland. That also touches on the fact that, well, we can talk more about indigenous peoples in that area, but there's a long, long, interesting history with that, too.
Well, we'll get to that in just a moment, but you're listening to Locus Focus on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Travis Williams, Executive Director of Willamette Riverkeeper, about how to address the harms perpetrated on our beloved river and envision a healthy, happy Willamette for generations to come. While we're on Lytton, I want to talk about that hill that got built as part of the mitigation. Because I have friends who say, what is that hill that's there and that just on behind the commercial strip on in Lytton? How did it get there and what is it about?
The mystery of the Lytton Hill. I don't know the all of the details of why they designed that project that way, and maybe that would be a question for RestorCap that did that project. But my sense is that they had to move a lot of the material that was upland at that site, meaning kind of a higher bank with quite a bit of soils that went up several feet. And they moved that material in order to create this artificial river channel that goes in a little bit in the floodplain. And so the reason that they want to build that type of habitat, meaning the floodplain habitat, is that's where juvenile salmon would like to get off of the main stem of the river to get a little bit of protection from high flows, to be able to feed. And that's the type of habitat that really we have lost along the entire Willamette, not just the Portland Harbor stretch, and we're trying to get it back. And I think what happened there is they removed so much material that extra soil, if you will, was used to create that mound rather than trying to take it somewhere else and dispose of it. So that's my best guess. There may be a better answer than that, but I think that's what was going on. And again, I think that the lost opportunity there was you can figure out ways to have public access where you can limit potential impacts on habitat that you're trying to restore from people walking around on it or through it. And I think there could have been some creative ways to do that that would have satisfied a lot of folks in Lytton and created some really good access. So that was, again, unfortunate that did not happen.
Well, the weird thing about that hill is they planted it with some non-native flowers, which are sort of pretty in a very weird way, but it kind of reminds me of the dredge spoils that the Army Corps of Engineers dumped on the west side of I-5 across from where Mount St. Helens spewed a huge amount of silt and debris into the...
Oh, yeah. The Corps has done wonders across the United States in creating places that were once natural and just all kinds of interesting things from, you know, the dams to how they, you know, deal with dredge spoils, if you will, use that term. There's so many islands. I paddled that whole stretch from Portland down to Astoria in a canoe and a few years ago, and so many of the islands look so odd because the ends of them are basically dredge spoils, and they're stacked up really high with that kind of large granular sand that comes from the Columbia. At least in my view, that's what it is.
Well, some of the weird stuff about the Lytton Hill is that it supposedly you're not supposed to be able to go up on it. It's not for public access, though I think people do access it. And it also gives you, if you do get up there, a great view of what you could see if they'd only let you down there. So
right. How ironic. Yeah. I don't know. I'm hoping in time there's a way to do that. And again, we've talked with, there's a whole parallel process with a Superfund cleanup, and it's called the Natural Resource Damages Act, which is designed to restore habitat in tandem with a Superfund cleanup and usually after. And so some funds are generated. So it's one thing to reduce exposure to contaminants from a Superfund cleanup process. And it's also important to remember that it's never truly cleaned up. You have a reduction of risk to people and wildlife. So there can still be contaminants either under a cap, but it's never a true cleanup. And I think we have to be careful with how we use that term. But again, in parallel with those processes to clean up sites, whether it's an upland site or a river site, there are funds that are generated and decided upon with a trustee council that includes NOAA Fisheries, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the state fish and wildlife departments, and then the tribes. And they identify potential restoration projects that can be done. And Linton at that time was one that was more or less approved from that process. And that's not laying the blame on them. I think their focus was, you know, we want to restore some habitat. But it would have been a great opportunity to really get at that public access piece of this.
Well, speaking of the tribes, I wanted you to talk a little bit more about the relationship that Indigenous people have had historically to this area we're talking about and the role that they're playing now in trying to get some of that back.
Yeah, and, you know, we at Willamette Riverkeeper, we've had some really and still have some great relationships with different tribes. Working on different projects. We partner with Grand Ronde and others over the years in looking at freshwater mussels that live in the Willamette, which incidentally can live to be over 100 years old in the right habitat. But you think of the tribes, predating the arrival of white people on ships and spreading disease. And then, of course, the immigration of white people to the Northwest, which, of course, really changed things. But you try to imagine before that time, the use of the river that is very well chronicled in terms of fishing and gathering and then hunting in the uplands and all the villages that used to exist down around Sylvie Island and in the lowlands along the Columbia as you go downstream. And then from Willamette Falls, where there was an active fishery, not unlike Celilo Falls on the Columbia, where they have fishing platforms, just the area was so well suited to supporting people given its natural bounty, if you will, in terms of the food availability and the relative climate, relatively mild climate, I should say. And, you know, I think the good thing, even with all the harms that have been done and the racist crap that Indigenous people still face today, which is just insane in my view. But with all of the harms, there's a lot that is positive and going on in a very good light in terms of reconnecting with some of the traditional ways. And you know, from group to group, it certainly varies, but there's a lot of good stuff happening in Oregon and throughout the Northwest. And I think of, you know, the different canoe families that have gotten together. They build dugout canoes. They paddle them. They get together typically annually. Most of the tribes have taken part in that, and they've reconstructed, to a really fine degree, the canoes of the past. There was one found on the Sanium, actually, quite a few years ago. That's called a shovelnose canoe, and it's a little bit lower down to the water, fairly shallow in terms of its volume, but it was like the perfect canoe to allow you to harvest and to fish because it was so low to the water and it could go into backwater areas. And we know that those types of canoes existed up the Willamette. There were accounts from the 1800s on the Sanium, for example, that cited numerous canoes on that river. So that part of the culture is huge. And then reconnecting with the first foods, of which, you know, there's so many that still grow today. So I see all that stuff as very positive, and I think many, many tribes continue to build on that and continue those ways, and it's really a cool thing to see. And then they are able to share their knowledge with folks who might be doing habitat restoration. They have information to share that could be beneficial to ecological restoration, hearkening back to those ways of decades past. So that's a really cool connection with many of our tribes in the Northwest.
Well, a few weeks ago, I had the pleasure to go to the Hanford Journey out at the Hanford Reach, which is it was going to be an annual event. The first one was 2019, and the one this past month is the first one since COVID. And it's a partnership between the Yakima Nation and Columbia Riverkeeper. And this year, the Puyallup canoe family came down, and they brought their canoe with them, but they couldn't put it into the river because the river was about 10 times wider at that point than it normally was.
Right.
In fact, where we were gathering, there's supposed to be a boat launch that was underwater too. So unusual high water year this year. But it's one of the things that I have become very fascinated by in learning more about the Yakima Nation's relationship to the Willamette River, because it's not just the Columbia River that they relate to, but they also have treaty rights, basically, to the Willamette as a usual and accustomed place for fishing. And they would go to Willamette Falls to fish for lamprey, because the lamprey was much better down there than it was all the way upstream where they are, along what's now called the Hanford Reach. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the Yakima Nation's role in protecting the river, and also their role in getting the Portland Harbor cited as a Superfund site.
Yeah, I think the Yakima Nation has been very strident over the past, I would say, 10 years in relation to Portland Harbor asserting their rights and being involved in the process that led us to get to the Record of Decision, which is sort of the term of art for you've reached your cleanup plan for the Willamette. It doesn't contain all the details, but we got that at the very end of the Obama administration, thankfully. And the tribe in those, I would say, the 5 years leading up to that was very involved in providing comment on a lot of the technical documents and really helping to push the needle to get to the best cleanup we could get. I don't think any of us are completely satisfied with the final product, but at least we got there, and now we're hopefully going to see in-water work in the next year or two. And it's hard to believe sometimes when you think of the time scale involved with this type of an environmental exercise, if you will, to reduce risk to people and wildlife. And it's very, I think, challenging at times to really keep track of, but we are getting close, and it's not going to happen this summer, but potentially the summer of 23 and 24 to begin actual removal of contaminated sediment from the river. So it's a very positive thing. But I think all the tribes in our area have such a strong role and increasing presence that is very positive. And again, not to bring the conversation back to freshwater mussels, but a lot of tribal folks are realizing that connection to that food source that may not have been their primary food source, but they have a very strong interest in restoring rivers. And I think of like the Umatilla tribe, Confederated Tribes of Umatilla, has done a lot of fantastic work to figure out how to propagate mussels in a hatchery that could be replanted and reestablished along Umatilla and other rivers. So we're beginning to see just so much great work that should yield results that really make a difference for the long term. And again, I think of the for those listeners who aren't familiar with freshwater mussels, we have just a handful of species in the entire West as compared with the Mid-Atlantic and the Southeast United States, where we have truly a world biodiversity hotspot for freshwater mussels. And these are organisms that filter feed, they're mollusks, and they typically can't evade predators. In our case, we have one that, you know, when it is fully grown, the western pearl shell mussel, it's about as big as your hand lengthwise, big black shell. Oftentimes it's very much been chipped away at by the river and rock and the movement of water. But those are the ones that can live to be over 100 years old in the right conditions. And it kind of resets the frame, if you will, of thinking about all of the impacts to water quality, to habitat, stream temperature. You look at it across that time scale, and here's an animal that it can't move very fast. It has a little fleshy foot that enables it to push itself along the river bottom. But it has to filter feed, and it has to take in whatever we send its way. And it has actually a positive impact on water quality. They've measured this with different species. If you have a big mussel bed, which is not uncommon, the water quality is actually better downstream of that bed than upper, typically. So there's a direct correlation to, you know, the health of our rivers by maintaining them in a way that helps sustain these species for the long term. And again, not to belabor the point on that species, but if you haven't seen them, you'll see big black shells along the riverside, typically above Portland. In the Portland area, because there's slower flows, we have another species that's in a genus called Anodonta, which encompasses a couple of different species of floaters, and they could still live to be 2 to 3 decades old, which is, again, fantastic. And you'll find those in Columbia Slough. There are areas of the Willamette that contain them. So just a really interesting nexus with everything that humans do to water quality and habitat. And it really makes a strong case for doing better.
Well, you're listening to Locust Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations, KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Travis Williams, Executive Director of Willamette Riverkeeper, about how to address the harms perpetrated on our beloved river and envision a healthy, happy Willamette for generations to come. I wanted to wind up the show by talking some more about the whole Superfund cleanup, and I wanted to talk about what it entails and what are the pollutants that they're trying to get rid of, and how do they get there in the first place?
Yeah, so the Superfund site is 11 miles roughly from the Fremont Bridge in Portland, almost all the way down to Multnomah Channel. So you're about 2 miles shy of the Columbia proper at the confluence there. And PCBs are kind of a leading pollutant that is probably the chief pollutant in that whole site, though we have areas that manufacture DDT, for example, and that has a breakdown product that is highly toxic. But again, if you think about all of that industry along the river going back 100-plus years, PCBs were a widely used substance that was in everything from transformers that you saw up on telephone poles to help keep fires from occurring in those electrical devices, and a lot of other applications. And the problem is that they're very pervasive once they get released into the environment. They bind with molecules at on the river bottom, and they happen to be pretty toxic when fish consume them, and then when people eat those fish. And so you've got a nexus there with human health, and you have a nexus with ecological health. There's a whole range of other pollutants as well, but typically at more de minimis levels, other than the site that's highly contaminated with the breakdown product of DDT. So if you imagine kind of a patchwork of sites all up and down that 11-mile stretch of river, some of those are polluted enough where you will actually have to go in and remove that soil and remove that sediment. Other areas utilize a technology, if you will, called capping, which is just putting clean layers of material over the polluted stuff to keep it from further exposure to the environment. And, you know, the difficulty with these processes is that they're not perfect. They cost money. And, of course, money became a big issue with how much dredging would occur with this project and how much capping would occur. And in some cases, if the levels of pollution are low enough, they being the US EPA and the Oregon DEQ and those who created the problem and have the liability for it, actually have something called natural recovery, whereas you basically do nothing except allow the river's natural sediments to cover over the contaminated stuff. So it's, you know, we're going to have a river that's in better shape than we've had in probably the last 100 years. That being said, the cleanup's not going to be perfect. The good thing about Superfund is that it is a polluter pays law. So the government is not paying for this. Each individual entity, and there's over 100 of them, who have legal liability for the Superfund cleanup, and there it is, I use that word again, they have to pay for it, not you and I. And in the cases where the EPA has had to do a cleanup, there are ways to recover that money through the court system, which could be pretty problematic for those who are choosing to fight their responsibility under this law. So it's a process we could talk literally for 2 hours about and numb everybody's mind. But at the end of the day, just know that we will, within a couple of year time frame here, have active efforts to remove that contaminated material off the river bottom, and that is being paid for by those who hold that liability.
Well, Travis, actually, when you come back to Portland, maybe towards the end of the summer or in the fall, we could have that hour discussion about what's going on with the Superfund site, because I think it's something that Portlanders are just really beginning to be aware of. So would you like to do that again? And you can come this time.
Oh, that'd be great.
And you'll be in the station this time.
Okay.
So
we'll talk. I'm back home in a day or two, so I'll be around.
Okay, great. Well, we'll talk about doing it in the fall, probably, or late summer.
Sounds great.
Okay. Well, one last question here in the last few moments that we have. How do you envision the Willamette being in, let's say, the next 20, 30, and 100 years?
Yeah, that's It's a tough question because there's so many moving pieces, if you will. I mean, again, if we think about climate change and the availability of water with the, you know, while the folks should know that the main stem Willamette does not have a dam, but most of the major tributaries are dammed and they're principally for flood control. So, but let's suppose that we have some water to work with. I think there's a lot of good work going on now to acquire land along the Willamette upstream of Portland. I think we're going to see that within the city of Portland for greater public access. Generally, the river is safe enough to utilize for recreation. And I hope that we have a more robust, cleaner river with more public access sites and more healthy habitat. And I think there's a real opportunity for that. And frankly, it's something that we just have to do.
So how do we do that? I had a conversation with Mingus Maps a number of months ago about he believes he wants to get people on the river, but I felt like it was more like political posturing than it had any kind of practical plan to do it. So how do we get people on the river?
Yeah, I think the ways are we figure out all of these properties that are coming up that were formerly industrial, there are ways to acquire them and repurpose them. You know, McCormick and Baxter is the extreme example of that. But again, I think that would be a fantastic open space. There are other properties within Portland Harbor that could work for public access once they are cleaned up. And maybe the need for that type of industrialized land is not as great as it used to be. And we know that to be the case, actually. For a long time, they said, no, you can't take any industrialized land out of production. It kind of reminds me of what we hear sometimes in the agricultural sector. And the reality is, yeah, you can. And you can repurpose these properties. And you can create more opportunities for people to be along the river and get in the river. So I think with the resources that are out there, if you look at the bond funding that Metro has available for those types of acquisitions or similar funding, the resources can be there. And, you know, the public put their support behind those types of acquisitions and public acquisitions for bike lanes and connectivity between public properties. And I think this is another example of that. And I should also say, you know, there's a group of folks in the St. John's and Linton area and elsewhere in Portland who've been really trying to vision a trail along the east side of the Willamette, which would in essence be a greenway trail along the river. That's just the kind of thing that I think we're going to need, and we're going to figure out how to get placed.
Well, Travis, it's great to talk to you, and I really appreciate your optimism. So thanks for being on Locus Focus.
Hey, thank you so much. Appreciate it. You're welcome.
We've been talking with Travis Williams, Executive Director of Willamette Riverkeeper, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm and listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Ray Bodwell. Next week, we'll talk about heat pumps with Dylan Plummer with the Sierra Club and Nora Apter with the Oregon Environmental Council. We'll go out with music by the Talking Heads. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask when necessary.
we could have had. Love is a